From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Film historian Mark Elliott returns this week. He's written biographies of Walt Disney, Ronald Reagan, Cary Grant, Clint Eastwood, Steve McQueen, and Jack Nicholson, among others. His books are like a big jigsaw puzzle, which, when assembled, form a brilliant history of the art of the cinema. Mark Elliott's newest book is American Titan, Searching for John Wayne. Mark Elliott, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. Nice to be back.
In other discussions we've had here, you told me that Andrew Saras was a mentor of yours and a friend, and Saras popularized the theory of the auteur in cinema, and we usually think of the auteur as a director, like Hitchcock or Robert Altman. But in your new book, you argue that an actor, like John Wayne, can be an auteur.
That's right. When Andrew Saras began, he took his theory, he adapted the French theory, which is where auteurism began. And the way it came together was that the French New Wave did not have access, the New Wave critics, Truffaut, André Bazin, Romer, Chabrol, they all began as film critics, did not have access to American movies during World War II because of the occupation and the difficulty transporting them in those days. So when they got to see a Hitchcock or a Ford film, they could see five of them in a day when the war ended. And that's when they began to realize that films, individual films, aren't disconnected works of art, but they're a unified whole, much in the way that if you saw one Van Gogh, an early Van Gogh, and you didn't see a later Van Gogh, you really wouldn't have an idea of what the art of Van Gogh was. Saras was, when he adapted that to American film, his premise was that the critics of the 50s in America, with one or two exceptions, James Agee being the big exception, saw American films as inferior to foreign films, that they were just industrial products put out one after the other, while European films were more personal and more intimate. Through auteurism, Saras restructured American cinema and said, no, you've got it all wrong. It's the American movies that are great, and the European films, not so much. That theory really revolutionized film criticism in America. The premise of it was that a director shows a consistency of style, that runs through a body of work, and that's how you can compare one director to another. Midway through his career, after he was well established, he wrote an essay, part of which I quote in this book, that auteurism really could be expanded to producers, to screenwriters, and also, in some cases, to actors. And John Wayne really was the actor that spurred Saras's expansion of the theory. And one of the reasons is Saras always loved the underdog. He once said to me, if all the critics like a movie, I'm probably not going to like it, because that's my role. Mm-hmm. My role is to be the distaff rebel thinker. If all the critics don't like a film, I'll probably like it, because by definition, I am different from the status quo. Now, at the time he wrote this essay about John Wayne, nobody liked John Wayne as an actor. Excuse me, they liked him as a personality. They liked him as a cowboy. They liked him as the image of a soldier. But nobody sat around and said, you know, my three favorite actors are Marlon Brando, James Dean, and John Wayne. John Wayne was always just there. You know, oh, yeah, John Wayne. But, you know, that kind of was the key for Sarris to take a look, revisit John Wayne's films, particularly the ones with directed by John Ford, and see if there was a thread that ran through them that could define them in auteurist terms. And indeed, he found that thread. So when I read that essay, and having seen some of the John Wayne films at Columbia when Andrew Sarris was teaching, he usually showed the John Ford Sarris films. Also, he showed Red River and a couple of others where you could see threads connecting Wayne's work in a single body, where you could follow the thread of his work. But the important difference, and not to be overly esoteric, is that, sound overly esoteric, is that most method actors that came into prominence in the late 40s and 50s were Freudian-based. They were taught the Stanislavski method of looking inside and trying to connect a moment in your life that matched the moment that you were trying to act. So if an actor had to feel sad on stage, then he would think about a moment profoundly in his childhood that upset him so much, and then try to recreate that emotion, connecting it to himself. John Wayne is not a Freudian actor. He's a Jungian actor. Every performance led to the next performance by virtue of the compounding of this persona on screen. So he would arrive at every performance fresh, but brought with him this Jungian body of work that shaped his performances. And that's one of the reasons, I think, that people overlooked him, that people thought, well, same old thing. But as John Ford vividly proved, I think nowhere more powerfully than in The Searchers, John Wayne was indeed a complex, extremely talented, at times profound actor. And the purpose of this book, what makes it a little different from most, is that it defines Wayne through his films, and it defines his films through his life, and that's what this book is all about.
Well, just to kind of define it a little more for us, let's take an actor like, say, Clark Gable. Gable made a lot of films, and he made probably as many as Duke, although Duke made so many of those B pictures he probably hasn't beat. But he made a lot of movies. He played a variety of roles, although he did westerns and he did action pictures, primarily action pictures. Would you say that Gable is not an auteur, and what's the difference?
I would say that both actors, both Wayne and Gable, are what you would define as personality actors. Actors who project a personality rather than a character. And that's a difference that sometimes is difficult to perceive. The reason why Gable is probably not an auteurist actor is because he didn't have a single director who continually worked with him and developed a persona over a longer period of time. Now, Gable did work with John Ford, I think, once.
Mogambo.
Twice.
Right?
Mogambo, and the earlier version, Red Dust. It's really the same film, and Gable plays the same role 20 years later. So you have that. You have Victor Fleming, who did who took over Gone with the Wind and completed it at Gable's insistence. He didn't like the director who was too female oriented. He thought focused the film too heavily on Scarlett O'Hara and not enough on Rhett Butler. That was George Cukor. So Gable had Cukor fired and brought in Victor Fleming. Now, he had done several films with Victor Fleming. The reason why that's not the same as John Wayne with John Ford is because Fleming is not considered an auteurist director of a high level by the auteurists. In other words, he doesn't make the pantheon. He's somewhere in the middle. Wizard of Oz, Gone with the Wind. These are films that are more difficult to define through the continuing stylistics, a singular form of a style. Fleming is more of a director for hire, and he liked to work with Gable because they were both adventurous, both outdoorsmen, both very good-looking men, both lovers. So the connection that they have is more of an off-screen connection that allows Gable to project this romantic leading man personality. But there's not as much in a Gable as an interior actor, and you can't really find a through line of a stylistic consistency. So Gable, the biggest star that Metro ever had, the biggest male star, the most interesting thing about him is that he played all these romantic characters, and then when World War II broke out and his wife was killed, Carol Lombard, I think it was his third wife, and killed in a war bond raising a plane crash that followed a bond drive where she appeared in Las Vegas. That suddenly took him out of the fantasy world. He enlisted in the army and actually fought. I don't know how much action he actually saw, but he fought. So the real drama in Gable's life is almost beside the films. I mean, yes, Gone with the Wind is probably, many people consider it a great film. I personally don't, but a very enjoyable film. But that's about it for Gable. Whereas Wayne, you begin to see a stylistic through line beginning with The Big Trail in 1931, Raoul Walsh's film, and then you see it clarified and almost mythified in Stagecoach, and then you see it again in Red River, not a Wayne film, but you see it in Red River, and then you see it in the trilogy, the Soldier trilogy, the Cavalry trilogy in the late 40s. And then, of course, Sands of Iwo Jima, which he was nominated for an Academy Award. Then The Quiet Man, this out-of-left-field Ford, boozy Irish sentimentality attempt. And then you see it, of course, nowhere greater than in The Searchers. Then you see it again in The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. So these are, with the exception of Red River, these are all Ford-Wayne collaborations where you can draw a line, a rising line, that defines and proves a stylistic consistency. And so that would be the difference between a Gable and a Wayne. Gable, in his prime, the 30s and the 40s, much more popular than John Wayne. John Wayne, and the reason being that Wayne was never really a romantic actor. He was a character actor who occasionally had leading man roles opposite Maureen O'Hara most often. But, you know, women, that's not where the action was for Wayne on screen. It was the fist fight, gunfight, winning in the name of law and order, but not winning the girl. That wasn't Wayne's thing, but it was Gable's thing. So that would make Gable much more popular in the 40s. But Wayne, on the longer view, a much deeper and more interesting actor in auteur's terms.
You know, Wayne is far better remembered today, I guess, if DVD sales and so forth are an indication. I mean, they're always reissuing box sets of Wayne's movies and so forth. We're talking with Mark Elliott, and his new book is a biography of John Wayne called American Titan, Searching for John Wayne. Now, I know you always like to talk about different aspects of Hollywood in your biographies, And there's a kind of an overlap here. Well, they all overlap a little bit. In fact, I think you mentioned Jack Nicholson like in the first page.
That's right.
But your book about Ronald Reagan was very much about the B picture experience, and a good portion of John Wayne's career was in the B pictures. So what was what's the contrast between those two?
Well, the contrast is that Wayne, better actor, and I mean that's the simple answer.
Yeah.
Reagan was never jumped to A pictures. He had a chance. Jack Warner, this might be somewhat hyperbolic, but or hyperbole, but probably not. On the inside of Hollywood, these stories that seem ridiculous usually have a basis in reality. Jack Warner loved Ronald Reagan. He loved him personally. He loved him as a utility man at the studio. And also he loved him because he was the president of the Screen Actors Guild, and in 1945 saved Warner Brothers from going out of business during that big strike. But even before that, Jack Warner did everything he could to keep Ronald Reagan out of the army, because Reagan was one of the few leading men that he could depend upon for B movies and what they called B plus movies. And after his success in one or two films, and Newt Rockne and one or two others, Warner, it's said, bought a script called Casablanca that he wanted Reagan and the It Girl. Her name slips me for a second. Did a lot of films with...
Was it Ann Sheridan that he wanted?
It's Ann Sheridan. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Double Jeopardy, $60. Ann Sheridan, who was a huge star in the 40s. The Oomph Girl, I think. Not the It Girl. The Oomph Girl.
Yeah, the It Girl was Clara Bow.
Yeah. Warner loved their chemistry. Audiences liked their chemistry. They made some interesting films. Juke Girl, a film that everybody should see. It's a fascinating movie. Hmm. So Warner bought this script called Casablanca and wanted those two in it. But Reagan ran out of string and he had to go into the army. Didn't do much. He didn't get farther than California, but he was in. And of course, you know, that film goes to Bogart and wins him great acclaim and pushes him into the firm A bracket, from which he never leaves. Reagan doesn't get that chance and never gets it again, because by the time the war is over and Warner can return to full-time movie making and not part-time propaganda movies, which Reagan did a lot, his time is over. He's too old. And the reason he's too old is because he was a leading man. Whereas Wayne, when the war ends, is able to slip back into A movies at that time because he's not a leading man. So age actually makes Wayne more attractive. It gives him a maturity that he didn't have in all those 30s B movies, which are all the same movies. You know, they were curtain raisers. In the days of B movies, people would drift into the theater 7:30, 7:45, and to warm up the audience that was there. It was a newsreel, it was a cartoon, it was coming attractions, and then a B movie. And people usually came in the middle of the B movie and never stayed for the beginning of it. They stay for the main feature, and then too late to see the B or you know, the bottom half of the double bill. And the reason for that is really because they're all the same movie. All B movies are basically the same. If they're westerns, the banker is a bad guy who's stealing money. The bartender is in cahoots with him. The banker has a beautiful, innocent daughter who thinks he's the greatest guy in the world. And Wayne somehow gets framed for all the killings and the robbery that's going on. And the daughter hates him or falls in love with him, and then hates him when she realizes that he's going after her father. And at the end, after a few gunfights, the woman realizes she's in love with him, the banker is dead, and they ride off in the sunset. That's every B film. And so if you saw one or two of them and you came in the middle, you might say to yourself, I saw this film already. So you don't have to bother to stay for it. They were very formulaic and really very little room for stardom. Very few actors ever made the leap from being a B actor to an A actor. Today we have television, which picks up the slack for a lot of B actors, or would have been B actors. They now, television enlarges them somehow, whereas the screen would make them smaller. So Reagan didn't have the chance and aged himself out of movies and wound up as a success on television, and of course later on we know what happened.
I don't know, he was obscure. I can't remember what happened to him afterwards. Some kind of
some job. Yeah. He moved to Washington, I think, and took some job. I'm not sure what it was.
Well, Mark Elliott, you were talking earlier about how John Wayne was not a favorite actor of people of our generation, and I think that's one of the reasons for that is the same reason that people did not revere Bob Hope very much, which is that they judged him harshly because of his political affiliations. People remember John Wayne as being a Vietnam War hawk and his movie The Green Berets and so forth. Now, my mom used to say, I can't stand John Wayne, because she couldn't stand his politics. And I said, it's politics. Forget about that and watch what a great movie Stagecoach is. And she said, I can't possibly. And I sort of thought that was stupid. But now I realize, well, I can never watch a movie with Mel Gibson in it. So I guess I've come
so
to understand.
So there's something to that. That's right. You know, Wayne was never popular in Hollywood. When he was working during his prime, the 40s and the 50s, and that's one of the reasons why most of his films were shot outside of Hollywood, on location. Ford loved location, and so did Wayne. Rather than shooting in the studio, although they always did pickups in the studio afterwards, you know, interior scenes where they didn't have to do them on location. The reason he wasn't popular is because, however reluctantly, I think, he became the head of the blacklist. He ran it along with Reagan and one or two others, and that didn't sit well with most of the studios, because a lot of the best talent was taken away because of the blacklist. Actors, screenwriters, producers, directors were all hurt by the blacklist and had to leave Hollywood. And so at a time when the studio system was already crumbling and they were hanging on by their fingertips, television was coming along, there was a big antitrust suit against the studios that made them give up ownership of the movie theaters and the distribution, which is what killed the studio system eventually. So all these talents that had been tainted by their flirtation with 30s communism went east. They all went into television, the so-called golden age of TV, live drama. Those are 90% of those are blacklisted people, either acting in them or directing them or mostly writing them. Or they went on to Broadway. Someone like Arthur Miller, who couldn't work in Hollywood, blossomed on Broadway. And some of them went to Europe. Robert Rossen went to Europe. Carl Foreman went to Europe. And they had to stay there for the duration of the blacklist, and some of them never came back. So that decimated the talent pool at a time when Hollywood needed it most. People didn't forget that. When the tide turned, when Kirk Douglas hired Dalton Trumbo to write Spartacus and gave him screen credit, suddenly there was an instant and a momentous shift in Hollywood to the open left, away from the right. And all these people, it's like the end of High Noon, they all come out of nowhere, and hey, I'm a liberal too, you know, after the gunfight, after the shootout.
Right.
So that's what happened. And that's the reason why Wayne, I believe, didn't win an Oscar or wasn't even nominated for The Searchers or Liberty Valance or The Quiet Man, all these wonderful movies that were probably the best movies of their year in Hollywood. I think The Searchers, the best movie, one of the 10 best movies ever made in Hollywood. And for that movie not to be recognized, not even nominated by the Academy for any of the major categories, I mean, that's a political statement. That's not an artistic statement. And they finally give it to Wayne in 1970 for one of his weaker films, I think, you know, with The Eye Patch or True Grit. Just like they gave Chaplin an Academy Award when he was practically 100 years old and brought him back. So, okay, we forgive you. We're a new generation. We don't have anything to do with that. We forgive you. So that's the way the Academy works and still works to a large degree. So he wasn't well-liked, and people remember, what people don't remember is that he was a Reagan Democrat, like Reagan, but became disenchanted with left politics. And when he took over as the head of the MPA, the Motion Picture Alliance, he was already being talked about as someone to be looked at for his background. Why? Because he didn't enlist during World War II. And it was popularly believed in Hollywood that he didn't want to fight against fascists. Not that he was fighting along with communists, but that he didn't want to fight against fascists, that he believed in a certain way of life that became increasingly out of fashion, you know, this superiority thing of American white male domination, not just in films and not just in race, but interestingly and curiously, he married three Mexican women, or three Latin women, I should say. So, you know, those are the things that you say, wow, wait a minute, I want to know more about this. Why would he do that? You would never see that in a John Wayne movie, but you would see it in John Wayne's life. You did see it in John Wayne's life.
And I guess that little bit of complexity is what would lead the author of Phil Oakes' biography to write a biography of John Wayne.
Let me tell you something. Phil Oakes used to say to me all the time, the best actor who ever lived, John Wayne. He's his favorite actor. When Saris used to show John Wayne films, I would tell Phil, when he was still, you know, still Phil Oakes and not John Train, do you want to see a great movie? Come with me to Saris's class. And he would go, and nobody would know who he was. He'd sit in the back, and he would just marvel at these movies. After we saw The Searchers, the first time I had seen it was at Columbia. Phil said to me, we went downtown and went to the Village, hanging out at the Gaslight. He said, John Wayne's my favorite actor, and so it does seem weird. Let me tell you something. When I wrote Death of a Rebel, everybody said, "Oh, Mark Elliott, he's a communist." When I wrote Ronald Reagan, "Oh, Mark Elliott, he's a right-wing bigot." And so when I wrote The Eagles, "Oh, Mark Elliott's a degenerate music lover." So, you know, it just, I try to tell people, you know, I am the messenger here. This is, you know, I am, if I write about Adolf Hitler, that doesn't mean that I'm a fascist. Although I do draw the line there. I would never be able to write about something that I didn't love. All the common thread in all these books, these are people I admire, respect, and in some way love.
Well, it's a wonderful book, and everybody should go out and get it right now. It's called American Titan, Searching for John Wayne, and the author, my guest, Mark Elliott. Thanks so much for coming back to the show.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Mark Elliott. His latest book, American Titan, Searching for John Wayne. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.